the market doesn't matter. Is this going to be valuable to clients? Doesn't matter. It's really about, did you advance the existing knowledge in this field or not? My first hire in the US was our chief talent officer, because that was the person that was focused on working alongside me to really build a team. So it was not the chief commercial officer. It was not the chief marketing officer. It was the chief talent officer, because that was the piece that allowed me to really then hire all the team and we really put a Necton team together. Our bottleneck is not access to capital. It's access to talent. I could have 2x the money in my bank account. I wouldn't be able to grow twice faster.
Excellent. Virgilio, it's good to see you. Excited to have you on this podcast. And I wanted to start this conversation about the prehistory. What have you been doing before Stuart Health, and how did you come up with the idea? So let's start with that.
Yeah, so I started SORT during my, I started developing the technology behind SORT and during my PhD in electrical engineering. And the reason why I focused my PhD on building technology that we have today and focus really on freeing people from pain, fixing patients that have struggling with pain, struggling with physical limitations. The reason why I focused on that was because I felt very vividly when I was a young boy, the challenges that families face when they have to recover a loved one. And I saw that with my brother. I saw the challenges that my parents faced to deliver that kind of therapy to my brother, and that stuck with me. And so that's why when I started my PhD, I actually, the reason why I did my PhD was to get access to the funding needed to develop the technology, because this was, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago in Europe, especially in Portugal, it was impossible for you to get $150,000 ticket, an investment just with an idea, just with a PowerPoint, right? And the only way that I found out to be able to do this and get access to the funding was basically to write a research grant that was approved. The implication of that research grant would be for me to get a PhD with it. So the PhD was actually an unintended consequence of the main goal, which was get access to the funding needed to develop the technology. And so then in my last year, I was working with Marcio in some joint projects connected with SWORD. And that was the moment that I basically saw, yeah, I need this guy with me building SWORD because he brings the resilience, he brings the drive, he brings the technical knowledge that will really reduce the risk of us not being successful. And so then we created SWORD, and after that we spent 4 years in the lab, just keep developing the technology without touching the market, because there were several open problems in our technical field that needed to be solved in order for us to get to the market. So it was definitely going through the valley of death between 2015 and 2019. It was definitely challenging.
So you spent 4 years raising grants before getting it to the market?
So we've not raising grant, raising. So my first development happened during my PhD, and I got a research grant of roughly $100,000, right? And then we already had IP. We already had a technology, a product that we could demo, and we already had clinical validation. And even all of that allowed us to get a first angel investment at $150,000 in our first year, followed by a second investment in our second year at $250,000, followed by a third investment in our third year at $400,000. And on top of that, we were able to get a research grant, another research grant from the European Commission of $1 million. And that was the thing that really allowed us to accelerate. But we were really scrapping for any money that we could get access to because, again, it comes down to where we were born. But honestly, that served as well, because now we are a much more stronger company with a much more stronger culture because of those initial years.
What was the, maybe the product like, what was the initial goal of the product in getting in front of the customers at the beginning? And then how did your pitch change, as a separate question, between speaking about raising the grants and then going after the seed? How did your pitch change with that?
Actually, it was a massive change, right? Because coming down to the difference between a research grant and raising a round is that completely two different worlds that value different things. A research grant, the focus is on increasing knowledge, right? Increasing the pool of knowledge, the existing pool of knowledge, right? So certainty, it's very important, right? The market doesn't matter. Is this going to be valuable to clients? Doesn't matter. It's really about, did you advance the existing knowledge in this field or not? And then when you get to the startup world, no one really cares that you are able to size up the market to the second decimal point, right? And that was my mindset when I was in my PhD, was really about being very, very precise on all things. And I remember having a conversation with an investor where I was a little complaining that I was not able to exactly precise the size of our market, right? And that was bothering me, right? Because I knew that that was a problem from the world that I just came from. And he was like, well, what matters for you to get the scale right? Is it 100 or is it 1,000? Is it 1,000 or is it 10,000? And that was really a moment of inflection in my mindset, which like, okay, it's a game of approximations. And really the game of de-risking your access to the market. And that was actually a journey that it took me a couple of years to get done, especially more because in Europe by then, still to this day, you don't really have access to mentors that can really teach you and allow you to grow much faster. So basically you are growing by yourself, which by definition is much more slowly. But yeah, it was really, it was a challenging position for me.
Mm-hmm. And then that first seed investor you mentioned, how did you meet them?
I did a TEDx talk where I denoted why we built what we built, my personal motivations, and that was really the hook for him to come to me and then say, hey, I want to invest. And I was like, completely ecstatic, because it was the first time that someone came to me and said, I want to invest. And I was like, sure, I will give you 50% of the company for like $150,000 ticket, because I was like, Jesus, someone wants to invest. That's like completely, and that doesn't happen. And so, of course, our mindset there changed a lot in the following years. But yeah, that's how I met my first angel investor.
And then once you raised that funding, what did you do?
We hired a couple of folks. We doubled down on hiring more people to accelerate the development. And that was basically it, because we were clearly constrained in terms of access to access to limited access to capital led to a limited access to resources. And that was really what was constraining our ability to solve all of those problems, right? Which really require top technical talent and, of course, high intensity of that of those hours from those folks to be able to be successful. So, yeah, it really accelerated our development, which, yeah, was really slow. It took us 4 years to get to the market. First, because the technical challenges were really, really big, but also because it was not like we started with a team of 50 people tackling the problem. As it happens today, if you are a seed stage company, right? We started with a company with four folks, right? And then six, and then eight, right? And then another fundraising came. You are now 15, and that was it. Really, maximize, increase the number of human resources, technical talent to accelerate even further.
Mm-hmm. And the first product that went to the market looked like what, and what was it doing?
So the first solution that went to the market was basically the first solution that went to the market that we explored the market with was a solution that we did some pilots where we were deploying a technical solution for PT clinics to use these with their patients. Right? So you would go to a PT clinic and then you would use our digital therapists to keep recovering your patients at home. Right? And we really then understood how challenging it is to change healthcare to providers, right? And that was a moment where we realized if we really want to have the impact that we expect to have in healthcare, we need to become the provider, right? We need to be able to do everything. And that was the inflection moment when we realized that was the inflection moment when we really define what our solution would be. And then when we got to the market, there was a clear fit because we were thinking naively that our clients were providers when in reality, the stakeholder that had a problem, the problem that we were solving was the payer, right? The one that pays for all of healthcare costs of their member, their employees. So there was a clear mismatch where we were selling to these guys, but this one had the problems that we were solving. So then we shifted and then we target these. And in hindsight, I think the reason why we did that, reason why we went to providers first was because I think some we were afraid of the complexity of becoming a provider in healthcare, right? I think in hindsight, that was the driver, right? Which is, again, it's much more straightforward when you just provide a technology to a provider and the provider uses the technology. But then what I've realized then, which is still pretty much true now, is that, yes, you can try to avoid complexity, but that doesn't going to make your life any easier, as we saw. And so might as well fight complexity. And because in the end, when you overcome that complexity, your life then will be much easier.
But that sounds like a really big change in terms of the strategy of the company, whilst you had some folks in the company too. Like, did it take a lot of product change, product innovation? Did you shift things a lot based on that, or the changes were small?
It was not a meaningful product and technology change. Because we were developing all the tools for an external clinical team to use. And basically the model replaced for instead of having an external clinical team, you now have an internal clinical team to use those tools. So if anything, product development became easier because it's your team now using your solution, which makes the feedback and the improvement cycles much, much faster. So it was not a big product change because conceptually we were already developing the same solution, but now an internal team was using it, which just accelerated the optimization of product market fit.
Hmm. So would you say that that was the moment that you realized that you had product market fit?
No, the moment I realized we had product market fit, it was when we launched in the market in January 2020 and we got the first client in May, which was a $1.5 million contracted ARR client. And then at the end of the year, we got another client that was worth $4 million. That was the moment where, okay, we got product market fit. And of course, between those, we had smaller clients that we were able to acquire. But those two moments, like after 4 years in the market, 4 months in the market in May, we are able to close a client that is worth $1.5 million. And after 12 months in the market, you are able to close a client that has $4 million, that is worth $4 million per year. That was the moment where, okay, that's product market fit. Mm. And of course, leading indications of that, right?
Yeah.
But the moment where it's like, okay, there's something here, was when we it was after 12 months and closing those two clients.
Mm-hmm. I read in a lot of sources that you're mentioning that you met Vinod Khosla early. Was the time that you met him around there?
I've met, so I sent an email. So that comes down to how we raised our Series A. And our Series A, so again, as I denoted, we went from angel investment to angel investment to angel investment. And then it came a moment where, okay, we need to get into the market. We need to write the Series A to put together a commercial team, get to the market. And my first mindset was, my first approach to this was, well, look, I would love to rise from a tier one VC in Silicon Valley. I realized that I'm still a startup in Portugal. So let me raise the Series A from a tier two or tier three VC in Europe, right? All VCs in Europe are tier two and or tier three, right? Let me raise from a VC in Europe and then raise the Series B with commercial traction in Silicon Valley. And that was the plan, right? I spent five months in Europe meeting all of these VCs and getting a no right in the first meeting. And you know that the goal of a fundraising process is you do the first meeting and the goal is to get the second one and you get the third one, right? I won't go after the first one. Everyone was very obsessed on the key question, what's your commercial traction? And I'm like, I don't have any, right? What I do have is this IP where we created this amazing technology and that is unique in the world. We have this clinical validation and that really showcases that this works. And those two things together combined with this massive market, we will have something really valuable here. And the VCs in Europe were like, yeah, sure. When you get that something valuable, come back to me and we will talk. And I'm like, okay, that feels like a catch 22 for us. And so we were really in a dead end and running out of money. And so one night, it was like midnight, I sent a cold email. It was the only cold email that I sent to Cosla Ventures because I knew that they were contrarian and they didn't follow the herd in the sense that they didn't have to see what was the commercial traction, right? They were like thinking from first principles, science first. And then second, they didn't have to see which investor was already in the cap table before or which one was leading the round or which one was looking at the deal, right? They look at the science and I knew, well, this is a Hail Mary. I had zero expectations for this cold email to be even answered, saying no.
Yeah.
And I sent the cold email and it was super, I was really surprised to see that. After a couple of hours, I got a reply from Dillian, that is now a partner, that's Founders Fund, but by then was a principal at Cosla, saying, hey, I'm really interested in this. Let's schedule a call for the next day. And I'm like, okay, this is new. I do that first call, and it was the first time that person on the other side, the investor on the other side, had read our clinical papers and wanted to discuss the clinical papers, not the spreadsheet for the Series A with lots of stuff that is completely irrelevant, right? Really discuss the clinical stuff. And for me, that was like very refreshing. And from that one, after 3 days, we got a call with Vinod scheduled. And still now to this day, but by then, certainly Vinod was a god. It's like you're going to meet one of your heroes. And how after you just sent an email 4 days ago when you are meeting with Vinod now. And as expected, it was a very challenging discussion, right? Very technical, very demanding from an intellectual standpoint. But that by the end of that call, Dillian came back to us and said, hey, we want to invest. These are the terms. And another 2-3 weeks, we had a term sheet signed. And this was between first quarter of 2019. And And that was really, really surprising to us, because it was the first time that, and I talked about this in the past, it was the first time that someone looked at us and saw what we were, right? And saw the potential of what we had built. And from that moment on, we were in Silicon Valley. We had a tier one VC, and everything became much more easier. It was like going from the darkness to the light. It was really like that. Media became easier. Hiring became easier. Access to follow-up funding became easier. Everything became easier. And then we executed on it. But I am very, very grateful for Kozla and Vinod and also Dillian they took a chance on us. And we paid that handsomely, to be clear. But it's the merit, it's total on them.
Can you recall what you wrote in this email? Was it a very scientific one, or was it a more of a personal one? How did you went about it?
It was very scientific. I can send you the email. I think I put the email on a Twitter thread that I wrote. It was, this is what we've built. 4 bullet points. Let's talk. Right. Really down to not without any fluffy stuff in there. It was like, this is what we built. 4 bullet points that showcase value. I've attached the clinical papers. Let's talk. And it was as straight to the point as possible, because I don't want to have lots of words diluting the real value that we created. So it was really straight to the bullet points, which were like, this is what we've done. Mm-hmm. And it worked out okay. And it's now part of our story, of our history.
Incredible. Incredible. And then you raised the round from Vinod and Dillian. And then what do you do? What's the next steps?
And then basically we set up the team in the US. My first hire, which I think was very strategic, my first hire in the US was our chief talent officer, because that was the person that was focused on working alongside me to really build a team. So it was not a chief commercial officer. It was not a chief marketing officer. It was the chief talent officer, because that was the piece that allowed me to really then hire all the team and we really put an Ecton team together when we created the company in the US. And that was the first strategic hire. And then it's really like preparing going to the market so that we launched, so that we were really able to kill it when we were going to go live. And that happened in January 2020, which was actually it was, in a sense, COVID was an interesting moment to us, in the sense that moment where the market stopped allowed us to really catch up in terms of being ready. And because when we launched in January 2020, we were still not ready. But we had clients asking for marketing materials, and we didn't have those marketing materials. Right? So when COVID happened, we really saw that as an opportunity, as a crisis that shouldn't be wasted. And we really focus on making sure that we were really, really ready, because we thought we were ready when we launched in the market in January 2020, but we weren't. We were ready in March 2020. And so that was an interesting moment to us.
That chief talent officer you mentioned, how did you meet with them?
That's the thing about VCs, right? Really good VCs feed you talent. And I meet him to Kozla Ventures. And that still happens today, where we get access to the best talent to our investors. And the other day, a couple of months ago, I was actually talking to an investor that asked quite a 2021 question, which was, oh, we were discussing fundraising, and he told me, what about if instead raising X, if you raise 2X, can you go twice faster? And I'm like, well, this is 2023, so this is a funny question for 2023. I told him, and I believe, I deeply believe in this, that our bottleneck is not access to capital, it's access to talent. I could have 2x the money in my bank account, I wouldn't be able to grow twice faster. It really comes down to being able to access talent, because we have many, many projects that we would love to kickstart, but we don't, because we still don't have the talent we need to properly lead those processes. Mm-hmm. And so a great part of the talent that we hire today, but in 2020 was the same thing, 2019 was the same thing, came to our investors. And if you ask me, there are many things that a VC and an investor can do for you in terms of accelerating your growth. I believe that access to talent is the number one thing.
And I believe I heard a few times your philosophy when it comes to talent. But you mentioned earlier about hiring early stage folks and then letting them grow into positions, whereas the general consensus I hear around, aside of Vinod maybe and Khosla and the Founders Fund, the general consensus is go and hire high VP level positions and so on. What's your take on it?
I think so. I tried both, right? And for us, the one that works is really hiring folks that are still not there, but they have a high potential. Actually, I announced today to the leadership team a new hire, that someone that is going to join the leadership team. We followed exactly the same logic. Because, look, I think it comes down to, is this person going to do the best work of their life at your company, or they did that in other company and you are only hiring them in a different stage of their lives, right? Because if I look at some profiles that we have now, I definitely know that if someone hire them right now from us, they will not be working with the same level of energy, with the same level of drive, because they already made it. And that's the difference in mindset, is I still need to prove myself, right? I still need to make it. So I'm really, really doing my best and having a crazy drive to get to the results. And of course, it's much more safe. And that's why I think folks, leaders hire established profiles, because it's much more safe, even for you to explain to your board, oh, I'm hiring this SVP in this company that did this amazing thing. And no one will like say, oh, you're crazy. The other way, well, but if you hire a more junior folk to lead your commercial team, everyone will say, well, I don't think that person is ready. Sure. But if you get it right, then you will have a killer profile that is going to go with you and be fully driven to be successful. Where if you hire an SVP, first, they will come shape from a different culture standpoint, right? Not your culture, a different culture. And then, of course, the drive will not be the same, right? Because it's like, I already made it, right? So it's like, I'm going to work and it's going to be cool, but I'm not going to do the stuff that I did 5 years ago where I was still proving myself. And that's why we always optimize towards more unproven folks, at least for that position. It being said, sometimes it doesn't work out. There's implied risk there. And that's okay. It's part of the process. But when it works out, it really works out. I can give you two examples. Kyle, our commercial leader, started as head of employer sales, went from head of employer sales to VP of commercial, to SVP of commercial, and now is our chief commercial officer. George, our CTO, started as VP of engineering, grew to SVP of engineering and is now our CTO. And it's like the amount of value that we got just from those two hires really, really overcomes the many failures that we had using this model in the process. And so, but you take risk in the process, that's for sure.
Mm. And then how do you judge in an interview process for that drive? And how do you judge for having these skills?
It's really about, I really love to go into detail, into a specific project that they led or that they executed. And really then peeling the onion and going layer after layer after layer and seeing, were you doing the stuff or were you delegating? I can give you some red flags when it happens. A couple of months ago, I was discussing with a profile and I asked that profile to explain me about that specific project. And then I was like, okay, and how you did X? And she was like, oh, I worked with an agency to do that. Okay, how did you do Y? Oh, I worked with another agency to do that. And then like, okay, so basically you were a project manager, right?
Yeah.
It's like, are you in the weeds, doing the work with our teams? Tell me how you solve problems. Tell me the sense of urgency that you had solving those problems. Because in the end, that's really the truth is really about how you do things. And going to a specific example, a specific project, it's very powerful to understand that. More than you worked at company X, Y, or Z, because I had that. Before I had the mistake, that was a regular mistake that I did, thinking because X worked at company A, by definition, I like company A. So by definition, I'm going to like this profile. And there's zero correlation there.
Mm. And then I think you grew the team massively over the last few years. How can you manage that? How do you have small teams running inside, or how does it work?
So it will come down to, first, I still to this day approve every single offer. I think that's very, very important as a CEO to have the final saying in that regard. I don't know when I'm going to stop doing this, but it's something that is very valuable. And then it really comes down to the quality of the management team that you have. It really comes down to that. Right? Good managers will really drive the better out of their teams. Bad managers will create a team that is complacent, where underachievers feel comfortable, where overachievers feel frustrated. And so it really comes down to focusing on your managers and how good they are. Because that will really shape each team. And then have few managers as possible so that you really can have a high density of talent in that regard on the management positions.
Mm. But how do you train folks to become managers?
I think they train themselves in the sense that, look, I believe I'm a decent CEO. No one trained me to be a CEO. I think that's something that you are born with and you learn to become a good manager. And it's not, and of course you're going to fail a lot through that process, and that's okay, right? You need to have a culture that allows for that to happen in a non-judgmental way. But I think you learn how to become a good manager by yourself. I don't think you can really go and pick an individual contributor and say, now I'm going to teach you how to be a manager and that person is going to be a good manager. I think it's the way you are also a good athlete, right? You cannot pick a random person in the street and say, you're going to be an amazing basketball player, right? Even if I have the best coach teaching you to be a basketball player or how to play basketball, that doesn't work that way. I think you are born with it. And you have a drive to be a good manager and you know how to get there.
Hmm. And when, if we go back a bit into the business, how did you go from I believe in another podcast I heard that you went from 2 million to 100 million. But what did you change there? Did you change the product in any way? Did you change your approach of getting into market? What happened?
So yeah, so we expect to close the year. We are cautiously optimistic to close the year at $200 million contracted ARR, right? We surpassed $100 million for the first time in February. We are on track to do $200 million of contracted ARR by the end of the year. We basically, we are always optimizing our solutions, right? In terms of getting feedback to clients, getting feedback to members, getting feedback from our team, and always optimizing our solutions to really increase the win rate, right? Really remove all the no's, right? Okay, we got a no from this deal. Why? Because of X. Okay, let's solve for X using technology, using our product to solve for X. That's one thing that I think we did quite well. Actually, our commercial team, one thing that really highlights the difference about SWORD against other places that they've worked with is the ability that we go from, okay, we have a problem to a solution is now live, right? That happens very, very quickly. So I think that was one of the reasons of our success was this BS, this drive towards action and results, right? And then at the same time, we went from, we launched our existing solution in January 2020 that we launched in the market, still growing massively fast. But then at the same time, we started launching new solutions, right? That really another S-growth curve and another S-growth curve that keep compounding our main growth and allows us to accelerate even further. Even if the main business line, it's still growing exponential, right? But that allows us to compound our growth. Because the way it happens usually is when your main business line in other companies start saturating the growth, that's when you start thinking about new things, right? But then you have a mismatch in terms of timelines. In our case, we are still growing exponentially, and we are already thinking on, yes, we need to expand our addressable market. And I think we did that well. And I think that's one of the reasons why we are going so fast. It's not just because of the clear product market fit that we have. The clear product market fit in such a big market, which is the physical pain space, which is the biggest problem in healthcare. But at the same time, we are really extending the total addressable market with new solutions and really solving the complete surface of the problem. And I think we did those three.
Yeah. What's the thinking process behind these new product solutions? How do you come about the new product solutions that you bring out?
So it's about two things. Listening to our members. An example, Bloom, our women's physical health solution. That focus on physical pain and physical pelvic pain and pelvic health issues like urinary incontinence. Right? Listening to our members where we were very successful treating the low back pain or the shoulder pain problem of that member. And that member, because of the trusted relationship that she built with us, she came back to us and said, look, I don't feel comfortable talking about this to anyone else, but since I really love what you did or and how you solved my shoulder pain problem, I wanted to tell that I have urinary incontinence, and I wanted to ask you if you have a solution to that problem. And then you connect, and you don't act on a single data point, but you start connecting data points, and you're like, okay, there's something here. So that's the first one, which is listening to what your members are saying. The second one, which is equally important, is always reading what's coming out of the scientific field, right? Always reading papers, clinical papers, scientific papers about new things that are happening and new problems that are emerging. And then you start like connecting all the dots. That's what creativity is. It's the ability for you to connect dots. And for you to connect, for you to be really, really efficient, really, really creative, you need to really expand the number of dots that you have to connect. And that's really access to information. And our information comes from the clinical scientific field and from our members. And then we connect the dots and we use a little bit of ingenuity to get to our new solutions.
In having so many folks in the team today, how do you enable everyone to do that? Is it that you go and you speak to customers yourself every day, or did you build the team in a way that they should always listen to the users? And then what is that way?
Yeah. So everyone has access, everyone at the company has access to feedback from the members, right? Of course, anonymized and of course, kept of any kind of personal information, because what we want to use really the feedbacks. So everyone at the company has access to feedback, access to that information. And then we have a culture of experimentation, a culture of innovation. So everyone is should come up with new ideas, new solutions, and should seek that knowledge that allows them to do that. As an example, I talk every single week with members, right? And I do that because it allows me to really understand what we are doing well, what we should be doing better, which problems we should be solving that we are not. And sometimes in one of those calls, there's a light bulb moment, which like, actually, this is instinct, right? And so it's really being very obsessed in terms of which problems you should be solving, which problems you are really ready to solve, given your approach to the problem in terms of how you understand technology, how you understand AI, and that you are not solving. And so it's really exposing yourself to the world in the sense that let me get access to as much information as possible.
Mm. When it comes to investors, knowing that when you raise around, you're going to have someone on your board, how do you judge them?
That's a good question. I think, honestly, I think the analogy is the same thing with when you are talking with a candidate. The way that first phase of the process, which is what's the cadence of the conversations, right? What's the ethos of the conversations? What are the questions asked? Right? Are the questions really about the product? Are they really focused on our members? Are they really focused on the value? Or are they really focused on really going to a spreadsheet, right? How smart are the questions that they ask? And from that, you really get a really good gut check in terms of saying, yeah, this will be someone that I would love to be discussing stuff with, or like, yeah, I really can't stand this guy. And honestly, that's like the most important litmus test to understand, yeah, I want to raise a round from you because one, through this process, I already learned some stuff from you and your questions, right? And I think we're going to really work well together, because I don't see the board as this layer of there to give you a grade of how well you are doing. I see the board as colleagues that allow you to think better, to then experience, and allows us to accelerate towards something much better in a collaborative way, not in this one directional way where, yeah, you did that well. You did that. Well, that was poorly done. That doesn't work. And of course, to do that, we really are completely open and transparent to our board. So they have access to the same level of information as every single member of my leadership team. And actually, one thing that usually happens when we hire a new member to our leadership team, they ask me, what should I tell the board? I'm like, everything that you tell me. Same thing, because you really see them as colleagues, and I validate in an investment round is like answering your question, would I like to work together with this person side by side on? And that for me, the very important piece, because we never waste a round at the highest valuation possible. I always had offers with a higher valuation, We never optimized towards value. We always optimized towards if this person allows us to be a much better company in 50 years. If this investor allows us to be a much better company in 50 years, in the sense that I'm not optimizing towards what my valuation is going to be in 2 years. I'm optimizing towards what my valuation is going to be in 50 years. And that mindset really changes how you decide who do you work with.
I think you spoke a few times about being an outsider as well, yes. Which is, I think in the healthcare space especially, people believe the opposite. So why does it help you being an outsider?
Because it allows you to think through a different lens. And the reason why that's important is, look, if you've been in healthcare 20 years, the way you're going to look at problems is completely one-sided, because that's what you know, right? And it comes down to creativity. It comes down to what I denoted, connecting the dots. If all your dots are within the healthcare space, your solutions will be all solutions that already exist within the healthcare space, right? And by definition, those are not the solution to the problem. Otherwise, the problem will be solved by now. So what you need is to expand your knowledge from other areas so that you can really connect dots between what you are seeing in healthcare to what you saw in other areas, and really then come up with really original new ideas. And that's why I think it's so important, because, look, I came from the engineering field. My approach to solve problems in healthcare, it's not the traditional healthcare way of like, oh, let me hire another physician or another health coach to solve this problem, right? My approach to solve a problem is, look, I've just read a paper about large language models and generative AI, and I saw this use case, and actually I think that use case in a completely different area could be applicable here quite well. Right. And that's what original thinking is. And if you come from the healthcare world, your ideas will be the same ideas that've been tested and implemented and proven unsuccessful in the last 10 years. So that's why you need other things, other data points from other areas.
Mm. Speaking about great investors earlier, Can you recall things that you learned, maybe from Dillian, things that you learned from Vinod and some other folks that you have in mind?
Yeah, so actually one of the most important insights that I've learned that I thought was quite obvious when I've learned it was in my first meeting, during my first meeting with Vinod, when I asked him, what should be my priority, right? If I should do one thing, Vinod, what would that one thing be, right? First meeting with Vinod, and Vinod replied, always do right by your members. And I'm like, by then, was like, yeah, no shit, right? Like, yeah, sure. Just quite obvious. But then, what happens is, in your day-to-day, you are faced with lots of decisions of, I could do this to increase my revenue, or I could do this to increase my gross margin. And I know that my investors in the next round would like to see a higher gross margin. So I can do that. And by doing that, you are diluting a little bit the quality of care to your members, or the experience to your members. Or maybe to my clients, I could change the way I bill for the revenue here so I can maximize the revenue, even if they don't get the full value that they are expecting to get, right? And you are a founder, you are a CEO, you know that those decisions happen on a daily basis. So you really have, I was really, every single day to this day, I still remember vividly that quote every single week when we make a major decision. It's like, are we doing right by our members or not? Are we doing right by our clients or not? And that the more I mature and grow into this space, the more I realize that actually, contrary to what I was thinking, that's the opposite of obvious, because you will have many, many temptations, logical temptations, to do it differently. And it comes down to what I've denoted, which in the end, it comes down to what type of company are you building? Are you building a company to really squeeze a good IPO in 2 years? Or are you building a company for your kids to work at in 50 years? And that really changes the way you make decisions. And Vinod had that really long, long-term thinking, right? And I've realized, yeah, that's why you should always do right by your members. Even if your revenue could be like 25% higher this year, that's how you do things.
Incredible. Last question. What should we expect within the next 5 years if we are going to put a bigger horizon?
So what we are building SWOR to be the solution to pain. Independently of which type of pain you have, we want to be the solution to your problem. More than to be the solution to your problem, we want to make sure that that problem doesn't happen in the first place. And we are going to work in the next 5, 10, 20 years to be the first go-to solution if you have pain. You are not going after surgeries. You are not going after painkillers and opioids and injections and all of that wasteful stuff. You know that if you have pain, independently of your pain, you're going to go to SWORD and we're going to solve your problem very, very efficiently. And of course, for us to really be the mainstream gold standard of care in terms of how we solve pain in the world, it's going to take more than 5 years. But yeah, in the next 5 years and in the next 10 years, that's the goal, to work towards that.
Incredible. Virgilio, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. It was super cool. Thanks. Super cool.